The Christians lost Jerusalem again in 1244. It was taken from them very easily by the Sultan of Egypt when they attempted an intrigue against him. This provoked the Seventh Crusade, the Crusade of St. Louis, King of France, Louis IX, who was taken prisoner in Egypt and ransomed in 1250. Not until 1918, when it fell to a mixed force of French, British, and Indian troops, did Jerusalem slip once more from the Muslim grasp. One more crusade remains to be noted, an expedition to Tunis by this same Louis IX, who died of fever there. 11th. The essential interest of the crusade for the historian of mankind lies in the wave of emotion, of unifying feeling, that animated the first. Thereafter, these expeditions became more and more an established process, and less vital events. The First Crusade was an occurrence like the discovery of America. The later ones were more and more like a trip across the Atlantic. In the 11th century, the idea of the Crusade must have been like a strange and wonderful light in the sky. In the 13th, one can imagine honest burghers saying in tones of protest, "What, another crusade?" The experience of St. Louis in Egypt isn't like a fresh experience for mankind. It's much more like a round of golf over some well-known links, a round that was dogged by misfortune. It's an insignificant series of events. The interest of life had shifted to other directions. The beginning of the Crusades displays all Europe saturated by a naive Christianity, and ready to follow the leading of the Pope trustfully and simply. The scandals of the Lateran during its evil days, with which we're all so familiar now, were practically unknown outside Rome, and Gregory VII and Urban II had redeemed all that. But intellectually and morally, their successors of the Lateran and the Vatican weren't equal to their opportunities. The strength of the papacy lay in the faith men had in it, and it used that faith so carelessly as to enfeeble it. Rome has always had too much of the shrewdness of the priest and too little of the power of the prophet, so that while the 11th century was a century of ignorant and confiding men, the 13th was an age of knowing and disillusioned men. It was a far more civilized and profoundly sceptical world. The bishops, priests, and the monastic institutions of Latin Christendom before the days of Gregory VII had been perhaps rather loosely linked together and very variable in quality, but it's clear that they were, as a rule, intensely intimate with the people among whom they found themselves and with much of the Spirit of Jesus still alive in them. They were trusted, and they had enormous power within the conscience of their followers. The church, in comparison with its later state, was more in the hands of local laymen and the local ruler. It lacked its later universality. The energetic bracing up of the church organization by Gregory VII, which was designed to increase the central power of Rome, broke many subtle filaments between priest and monastery on the one hand, and the countryside about them on the other. Men of faith and wisdom believe in growth, and their fellow men. But priests, even such priests as Gregory VII, believe in the false efficiency of an imposed discipline. The squabble over investitures made every prince in Christendom suspicious of the bishops as agents of a foreign power. This suspicion filtered down to the parishes. The political enterprises of the papacy necessitated an increasing demand for money. Already in the 13th century, it was being said everywhere that the priests weren't good men, that they were always hunting for money. In the days of ignorance, there had been an extraordinary willingness to believe the Catholic priesthood good and wise. Relatively, it was better and wiser in those days. Great powers beyond her spiritual functions had been entrusted to the Church, and very extraordinary freedoms. Of this confidence, the fullest advantage had been taken. In the Middle Ages, the Church had become a state within the state. It had its own law courts, cases involving not merely priests, but monks, students, crusaders, widows, orphans, and the helpless were reserved for the clerical courts. And whenever the rites or rules of the Church were involved, there the Church claimed jurisdiction over such matters as wills, marriage, oaths, and of course over heresy, sorcery, and blasphemy. There were numerous clerical prisons in which offenders might pine all their lives. The Pope was the supreme lawgiver of Christendom, and his court at Rome the final and decisive court of appeal. And the Church levied taxes. It hadn't only vast properties and great income from fees, but it imposed a tax of a tenth, the tithe, upon its subjects. It didn't call for this as a pious benefaction. It demanded it as a right. The clergy, on the other hand, were now claiming exemption from lay taxation. This attempt to trade upon their peculiar prestige and evade their share in fiscal burdens was certainly one very considerable factor in the growing dissatisfaction with the clergy. Apart from any question of justice, it was impolitic. It made taxes seem 10 times more burdensome to those who had to pay. It made everyone feel the immunities of the Church. And a still more extravagant and unwise claim made by the Church was the claim to the power of dispensation. The Pope might, in many instances, set aside the laws of the Church in individual cases. He might allow cousins to marry, permit a man to have 2 wives, or release anyone from a vow. But to do such things is to admit that the laws affected are not based upon necessity and an inherent righteousness, that they are, in fact, restrictive and vexatious. The lawgiver of all beings most owes the law allegiance. He of all men should behave as though the law compelled him. And it's the universal weakness of mankind that what we are given to administer, we presently imagine we own. 12. The Emperor Frederick II is a very convenient example of the sort of doubter and rebel the 13th century could produce. It may be interesting to tell a little of this intelligent and cynical man. He was the son of the German Emperor, Henry VI, and grandson of Frederick Barbarossa, and his mother was the daughter of Roger I, the Norman King of Sicily. He inherited this kingdom in 1198, when he was 4 years old. His mother was his guardian for 6 months, and when she died, Pope Innocent III, from 1198 to 1216, became regent and guardian. He seems to have had an exceptionally good and remarkably mixed education, and his accomplishments earned him the flattering title of Stupor Mundi, the amazement of the world. The result of getting an Arabic view of Christianity and a Christian view of Islam was to make him believe that all religions were impostures, a view held perhaps by many a stifled observer in the age of faith. But he talked about his views, his blasphemies and heresies are on record. Growing up under the arrogant rule of Innocent III, who never seems to have realized that his ward had come of age, he developed a slightly humorous evasiveness. It was the papal policy to prevent any fresh coalescence of the power of Germany and Italy, and it was equally Frederick's determination to get whatever he could. When presently opportunity offered him the imperial crown of Germany, he secured the Pope's support by agreeing, if he were elected, to relinquish his possessions in Sicily and South Italy, and to put down heresy in Germany. For Innocent III was one of the great persecuting popes, an able, grasping, and aggressive man. For a pope, he was exceptionally young. He became pope at 37. It was Innocent who had preached a cruel crusade against the heretics in the south of France, a crusade that presently became a looting expedition beyond his control. So soon as Frederick was elected emperor in 1211, Innocent pressed for the performance of the vows and promises he had wrung from his dutiful ward.